You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 14th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jamie McCallum, professor of sociology at Middlebury College and author of Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. Later in the program, Garrett Bruharg, a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, will be joining us to explain the latest breakthrough in fusion energy and what it really means. Meanwhile, Biden officially signed the Respect for Marriage Act into law yesterday, mandating federal recognition of same-sex and interracial marriage and protecting couples from Supreme Court extremism. Senator Bernie Sanders withdrew a vote on his Yemen War Powers resolution after clashing with the Biden administration, who thought the vote would complicate diplomacy with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, they're the brutal regime conducting this proxy war. We'll talk about that more in a bit. Despite indicators all pointing towards inflation subsiding, the Fed has decided on its seventh rate hike of 2022. Smaller than before, but still, the contraction is inevitable. And the point. The framework for the government funding bill has been agreed to by top negotiators. It's expected to be done by December 23rd. Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene are lobbying on Kevin McCarthy's behalf, reports indicate, whose path to a successful leadership vote has become a bit more rocky. With a surge of migrants crossing the border, the Biden administration is reportedly moving to expand a program creating a legal process for Venezuelan, Cuban, Haitian, and Nicaraguan migrants to seek asylum ahead of the expiration of Title 42. Although, it's like a side program meant to dissuade them from coming across the border. We'll discuss that more in the program. The U.S. is set to approve the sending of its most advanced ground air defense system to Ukraine. Tesla's shares have fallen by over a quarter since Elon Musk acquired Twitter, and investors are voicing some concern. In Iran, 400 have been sentenced to up to 10 years in prison for protesting. And lastly, outgoing Oregon Governor Kate Brown has announced that she will commute the sentences of all 17 individuals on Oregon's death row to life in prison sentences, which is admirable. Good on Kate Brown. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. As a reminder, Sam is out this week, cruising around somewhere on the globe.
Gilligan out there.
Yep. that beard is going to be...
I mean, we haven't heard from him, so
far. We have not. I figured if he was having a bad time, we'd hear some complaints.
I'll send you some dispatches.
Right. So maybe he's having a really nice time. Maybe he's going to be a cruise guy from here on out. The collared shirts turn to ones with Hawaiian flowers on them.
Double festine, sort of coconut, hollowed out coconut born margaritas.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's like a 30 Rock episode about that brand of people. They're called the Crab Catchers. He's going to move to Central Florida and just live the good life.
Hey, I've actually, my grandparents took me on a cruise about a decade ago, and the Cayman Islands Margaritaville. Shout out.
I mean, what more can you ask for, really? So he will be back next week, but we have two guests today. I thought it was important to have someone who actually is scientifically literate to speak on the breakthrough in fusion power, which looks incredibly exciting on its surface, and it is in terms of the technological achievement, but we need someone to put into perspective how far along some of the science might be and what some of the obstacles might be as well. But first, I want to talk about the this Yemen war powers controversy. So Ryan Grimm yesterday was doing a lot of reporting and updates on the Biden administration and their opposition to Bernie Sanders' war powers resolution that was coming to a vote in the Senate. They were expected to vote yesterday night. That did not happen. The White House didn't want to publicize that they were privately urging senators to vote against Bernie Sanders' Yemen war powers resolution, but that was the case. And their argument was that a vote to curb the United States' support for the war in Yemen, which, by the way, has killed over 11,000 children that we know about, and it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the Yemeni people are being used as human sacrifices, essentially, for a war between those two powers in that region, with our tax dollars benefiting it. They were essentially saying that despite the ceasefire essentially lapsing, also because the United Nations brokered peace has expired, that the war powers resolution would increase the likelihood of more violence, which is not the case, but they have to kind of position themselves in that way. This is a White House spokesperson, or I should say press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, being asked specifically about the updates in this instance. This was before Bernie Sanders actually had to, or chose to withdraw the war powers resolution on the urging of the Biden administration. We can discuss if that was a smart choice or a good one after these comments.
Okay. Is the White House whipping against Senator Bernie Sanders' war powers resolution that's set for a vote in the Senate tonight?
Look, we've spoken to this before. I don't have anything much more to add. I know my colleagues actually was asked this question last week. Don't have anything more to really discuss or lean into on this.
Bernie Sanders just said that he's dealing with White House opposition to it right now. So just hoping for a confirmation of what all is going on there.
I'll say this. We're in touch with members of Congress on this. Thanks to our diplomacy, which remains ongoing and delicate, the violence over nearly 9 months has effectively stopped. As we have seen during this administration, the situation is still fragile, and our diplomatic efforts are ongoing. So we want to make sure that this is not impacted and the people of Yemen do not suffer, or that any of the progress we have made is overturned. Again, I really don't want to get ahead of the progress. We continue to work with Congress on this. We're having the conversations. I just don't want to get ahead of that.
It sounds like you might veto that if it comes to this.
I'm just not going to make a prediction. I'm certainly not going to make a prediction of what the president is going to do, is not going to do. We're having conversations with members of Congress, and I'm going to leave it there. Thanks, everybody.
Mm. Reading very carefully from her notes at one point, the reality was that, yes, the Biden administration was whipping votes against this resolution. The reason that they don't want to say that is because, one, it's unconscionable, and two, it is in direct contradiction with their attempt at a public posture on this. Biden, the officials that now populate the Biden administration had signed a letter. There were two separate letters, one signed actually by current CIA Director Avril Haines and Secretary of State Blinken in 2018 in opposition to the war in Yemen, and then one in 2019, which included Susan Rice, Jake Sullivan, other people within the Biden administration, essentially saying that Donald Trump, his veto of the Yemen war powers resolution was that they were opposed to it. And now they're trying Oh, I'm sorry. Avril Haines, Director of National Intelligence, not CIA. I apologize. I misspoke. That opposition, they, now that they're in power, essentially, they have changed their position entirely because this is an almost identical situation. Except now the Biden administration is worried and being held hostage once again by Saudi Arabia when it comes to gas prices and price gouging. That's why Biden had to go and fist bump MBS. But also, the thing that I think is mostly driving this is the Biden administration wants these kinds of decisions to be at their discretion and not at the discretion of Congress. The War Powers Resolution would claw back the White House's basically ability to unilaterally make these decisions, and they would have to go through Congress. And that is, I think, the precedent that they are afraid of. A few years ago, months ago, the Biden administration announced that they were going to end all support for offensive operations by Saudi Arabia and Yemen, which was essentially didn't have any teeth to
it. They defined it all as defense.
Well, everything is defensive. Our drone strikes where we kill innocent people are defensive. Israel's operations where they kill children in Palestine, that's defensive. Anything can be classified as defensive. And so the Biden administration issued a press release saying we're ending our support for offensive operations. And hey, the reality is that we just do it a little bit more secretly, support for this unconscionable war.
What are you saying about like that limits our diplomacy? Well, it's like it limits you using war as part of that diplomacy and puts that back in, takes it out of the executive branch's exclusive purview.
That's what they're afraid of. They want it to be, well, we can make tweaks, but still, this should be our choice. And talk about like what the founding fathers intended. This is in direct contradiction to that. These kinds of decisions were supposed to have the check of Congress, the check of that branch of government. And Bernie Sanders choosing to withdraw this at the urging of the White House, despite the fact that he had been getting significant bipartisan support, and it might have still failed. I mean, but there were some Republicans in the House who indicate that they might support it, and then you had Mike Lee, who was on board with this as well. So there was a path forward potentially, but Bernie Sanders essentially took the word of the Biden administration and said, I'm going to withdraw this so as to not create tension, and then we'll work together behind the scenes to end Yemen, our support for the war in Yemen. But why would you take their word for it based on what I literally just described, which is that they made a big announcement about how they were ending off a support for offensive operations, and in terms of like substance, that meant nothing. We're still doing it. We're still doing it.
I mean, the irony is, despite what sort of anti-Bernie people think, he's a party man.
He didn't want to ruffle feathers on this instance, and he has a relationship with Biden. He chose to make this decision, and maybe the vote would have failed because of how the White House was whipping votes. I still think you go ahead with it. Yeah. I still think, and I'm wondering what Chuck Schumer's role in this as well.
Well,
it was probably as a proxy for the Biden administration.
House, yeah.
But in terms of whipping votes, like, he might have gotten enough, and so Bernie might have not wanted to see it fail, essentially. But Saudi Arabia, the idea that we're just going to appease them and bow down to whatever this like spoiled brat MBS wants in order to not ruffle his feathers because there might be some domestic opposition in the United States to supporting a horrific war that we have no stake in, and people see the photos of starving and dead children and say, this is not something that we want our tax dollars funding, that's enough to ruffle that guy's feathers should be a sign that we need to end this relationship and move towards different energy sources as we begin our transition towards green energy. Just really, really pretty gross display of hypocrisy by the Biden administration. And they tried to be subtle about it by whipping votes behind the scenes. Good on our friend Ryan Grimm for reporting all of this. Otherwise, we might have not known.
I mean, there are certain things like discouraging a coup against Lula, for instance, that the Biden administration is good on. But overall, it's a very, very dark record beginning to forming. We talked about like the failure to move on the Iran deal early on. Also, the failure to renormalize with Cuba. The way Obama had, there's still sanctions there that's still starving people and causing massive sort of want there. And this, and like Blinken sucks. And like it's like you want more latitude for the diplomacy you've been demonstrating? No.
Why Blinken does suck is that for the reason you describe, but two, like a normalizing force when it comes to United States diplomacy, after so much was clawed back with reckless abandon by the Trump administration, is not enough.
Yeah.
There has to be restoration, not just stabilization, because then you're just continuing what was destroyed.
And that's the problem with actually like Republicans getting in office, is this is the class of Democrats that we have. And when they get back into office, they can pick and choose what they want to mm-hmm. restore and what they want to stabilize and what they want to completely ignore and put in their back pocket, like Title 42, for instance.
Exactly. All right. We are going to take a quick break. We first have a word from one of our sponsors, and you will hear Sam Seder deliver this message to you. Be right back.
Hey, folks. One of our sponsors today is also Great Gift Alert. IAC Laser Engraving. It's a leftist-owned worker collective started by a longtime listener of this program, a guy named Ryan Lubin. Started back over a year ago now, September of 2021. His company is democratically structured. They ensure any hierarchies are justified and efficient. They use sustainably sourced materials. They couple them with extremely energy-efficient laser technology, and they bring you really super unique products that you're not going to find anywhere else. So not only does your purchase of their items get you a one-of-kind product, also goes to directly supporting a business model that's structured around compassionate and worker-centered care as opposed to the more traditional authoritarian capitalist structure. But let's get right to the gifts here. They have all sorts of stuff that is really incredibly impressive. I've talked about the astronaut that Saul is going to get. Well, here, check this out. This is a owl. They have these in two different sizes. They hang right up on your wall like that. And you can see there, this is made out of, I think at one point, like 9 different layers. So it's 3D in many respects. And it's so cool. Precision crafted, again, different sizes if you want. Here is a, this one's like a Sasquatch. What else do you call it? A Yeti? It's got Bigfoot. Yetis inside, Bigfoot, and it's got multiple ones in there. It's a cool thing. You hang on your wall. You put it on your kid's table. You know, it stands right up there. You can't see that. It stands right up there on your microphone stand. Again, this is made from sustainable materials. This one's got 8 layers, and you can see that. It's really beautiful stuff. This one is incredibly impressive, and this one also comes in 2 different sizes. Here we go. This is a turtle. It's gorgeous. This is really beautiful. And you can hang it this way. You can hang it that way. 2 different sizes. Again, multi-layered, sustainable materials. They also have picture frames, beautiful picture frames made in the same way. They also have puzzles. They have a bunch of different puzzle sizes. And they can also do custom puzzles. And this is really a great gift for the holidays and also for like an anniversary or something like that, where you send in a photo. It's for a little bit more than the existing puzzles. Send in. They'll do a custom version of that. They'll do the, custom sizes. Really beautiful stuff. Check it out. Visit IACLasers.com. Order yours today and enter the coupon code MAJORITY10 at purchase, and you get a 10% discount on their amazing products. Again, that's IAC Lasers. One word, IACLasers.com. And then coupon code MAJORITY10, you get 10% off. Really great stuff. Great business model. And just fantastic gifts. So check it out. And now, we'll of course put that link in our YouTube and podcast description. Now, back to Emma. Emma?
Back.
We are back. And we are joined now by Jamie McCallum, professor of sociology at Middlebury College and author of Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. Jamie, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So the pandemic really birthed, I would say, the wide use of the term essential worker, and that's a broad umbrella term for nurses, medical workers, but to grocery workers, retail workers, as you describe. And they were essentially like the people that we needed to keep our society going during the pandemic. But that necessity was not translated beyond applause to recognition in the form of pay. I mean, that let's just start there, because that is the foundation of what you write about.
Right. Yeah. So the people I talked to about 100 essential workers in a million different industries. And their main concern was that the public applause and adulation and respect was never translating into some really material benefit. And so they felt both happy that for once, like, essential workers had always been there. They were always around. They're still around. We just gave them a new name for a couple years. And during that time, a lot of them were proud of that, you know, adage or that name. But, you know, really there was a moment of cognitive dissonance when it did not really amount to any sort of real significant transformation in their lives.
Well, they were called heroes and then they were left to die. That was the reality.
Yeah, exactly. So the hero worship thing was pretty interesting. The book starts in New York, where I talked to nurses who were walking into their hospital while applause is happening, knowing full well that, like, the, you know, members of the public, the government is not doing what it has to do to keep cases down. And there is a real tension there between that sort of respect and that, you know, on the one hand, then sort of celebrity status, but then lack of real respect. You know, heroes, superheroes by definition, don't need protections. They don't need government programs to help them out. They don't need a better boss. They definitely don't need a union. They just rise above the fray, right? And so in naming people heroes, I think we sort of, you know, undermined the necessity to really do right by them.
Right. And I mean, that is what I have a particular allergy to performative actions, but that I think is what stuck in my craw most of all about the applause. I mean, I'm here in New York and I couldn't really put my finger on why it bothered me so much. I what you also discussed was the expansion of the classification of essential workers as well, right? Which is that, yes, you spoke to those nurses, people who experienced the front lines there, but there were also people on the front lines who were deemed essential workers, and there was no real reason for it, like Walmart greeters you talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who amounted to an essential worker was very capricious, and it changed city to city, town to town, state to state, you know, neighborhood to neighborhood at times. So one chapter starts off with a woman who was a Walmart greeter and was deemed essential during the pandemic. She passed away, so I interviewed her mother. And a lot of people began to ask, well, why is it important that someone says, you know, welcome to Walmart every time you enter in the middle of the largest health crisis in a century? There were other people, like, you know, elite fly fishing guides in Montana were deemed essential because they're essential to the tourist economy in the summer of that state. And so there was a lot of, you know, politicking and lobbying behind the scenes to get one's business either considered essential or not. The other thing was is that some workers were deemed essential in some jobs while they were working in the front lines, but not in others. So I interviewed people who worked at fast food jobs who are universally, they're just like the lowest rung of the employment spectrum in America. Yet when they worked on the same day, their next shift was as a nursing aide, people were like, oh my God, you're an essential hero, right? Yet they were working at the same time. And so I think that speaks to the kind of subjective nature of what that designation really was.
I mean, within this classification of essential worker, there's such a broad range of workers, as you discuss, like those examples that you gave, and they're being put unnecessarily in harm's way because they are essential to capitalism, kind of like continuing to function at a certain level of profitability or viability for people at the top. And then there's essential workers working deemed heroes in hospitals and healthcare facilities, and they are, but that what they receive is recognition as a replacement for compensation. I mean, and that is that's the story of workers in the pandemic, or part of it, of course.
That's part of the story. Yeah, we need a new definition of what workplace heroism looks like, I think, because people did perform heroic acts that saved people's lives. Not all of it was just showing up day after day at your drudgery job. Like, we needed nurses on picket lines. We needed home care aides at the bargaining table. We needed teachers in the streets demanding that their families were priorities for vaccines. Like, they performed all these heroic acts that are largely considered disruptive to the status quo that really actually mattered quite a bit. And I think that kind of heroism has largely been forgotten to a large extent.
Definitely. I mean, other essential workers, like the Walmart greeters and the tour guides that you describe, like, what's your sense of what the point of that was, besides one, keeping the economy going? But part of it to me feels like there's a labor discipline element to it as well, which is that we're not going to let you sit on your ass. You're going to expose yourself because this is what our society is built on. You are supposed to be coming to work, and there certain people can stay home and work from home, but not your class of people.
Right, exactly. We prioritized the business culture of the largest employers. That's basically what some of essential work was. Again, as you said, completely necessary. Some of it, we just prioritized the sort of social and cultural habits and norms of large employers. If Walmart needs someone to say that when you walk in, then we're going to have someone to do that, right? If, in food processing plants, if the line has to go that fast for some ungodly reason, the line will go that fast. There was a lot of no exceptions to the way a lot of low wage and dangerous work happened. And I think people are unaware of, you know, we think of that always workplaces had sneeze guards and blinders, and people built all these protections in, and people got increased unemployment insurance. And a lot of jobs had none of that. And they faced, you know, their lives and their death down at work. And, that's not heroism. That's like being sacrificed. And so I think, you know, we should really, I hope that we've learned a little bit about the difference.
I hope so too. There have been some encouraging signs in terms of worker solidarity that I do want to discuss with you at some later point in the interview. But you also talk about how the essential working class disproportionately men and women of color, and how that played out alongside the Black Lives Matter movement and a wider reckoning about racism in the United States, systemic racism. And in many ways, that's an improvement in terms of the labor explosion of the 20th century where it was very white in terms of like the dominant unions and the recognition that those workers got versus now. So there's a difference in terms of those things playing out alongside of each other. Can you talk about how those came together?
Yeah. So one of the most important parts of the pandemic, labor-wise, as you said, was the ability of workplace organizing and community organizing or political organizing to sort of cross-pollinate each other. So, you know, many people from the, including Chris Smalls from the Amazon Labor Union, were leaders in the essential worker movement and were Black, are Black, and are leaders in Black Lives Matter. And so that mattered a lot. And then the essential working class is just disproportionately Black and brown and female. And so the racism, the sort of systemic racism and the interpersonal racism that workers faced at work had natural spillover consequences for the Black Lives Matter movement. The other thing that's interesting there is that Black Lives Matter began to talk about, you know, the strike for Black lives, and they began to really use the language of labor in a way that we hadn't seen before to some extent. And so the labor movement, you know, began to be to some extent led by these undercurrents of workers who were really coming up from below. And again, many of whom were Black and many of whom were female, many of whom did not have, were not even represented by labor unions. You know, a third of the strikes in 2020 were led by workers without unions. That doesn't happen like in normal times. Like workers just don't walk off the job or sit in or strike without an organization. So it was a pretty anomalous situation, but I think some of that energy has carried over and has continued to, you know, help build the Amazon movement, the Starbucks movement, some of the stuff happening among in higher ed, stuff like that.
I mean, when they write about this time, right, beginning with JFK 8 and Chris Smalls, it's that was the spark is the pandemic and the open disregard for people's health and their lives that just it's there was so much bubbling up. But that was really like a breaking point. And you talk about this in the book as in terms of like how workers need to can make gains when they create crises for capitalism. And it's almost kind of an inversion of the shock doctrine to a degree, where that usually when there's moments of crisis, that's when the military-industrial complex or big corporations see opportunities. And there was a lot of that. Pandemic profiteering, real thing. And just look into those PPP loans as well. But there was some of this, too. And that's encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the early days. Like, I interviewed Chris in 2020, a couple months after he was laid off. And he's like, we're not going to stop till we get unions at Amazon. My first thought was, well, we're not going to get unions at Amazon. You know, like we're not going to get it in good times. We're certainly not going to get it now. And then they won. And, you know, people began to think about workplace organizing in very different ways, I think. If you look at the official statistics for 2020, like the number of large strikes collected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there's nothing. There's 8 strikes. 4 of which were led by nurses. And I saw these stats and I was like, oh, nothing's happening really. That's weird. And then when I would call people, they would say, oh, by the way, there was a walkout yesterday, or there was a protest yesterday, or we all want to form a union, or people are walking out on strike here and there, or there was a sit-in. And there was all this stuff bubbling up from below that was to some extent, you know, less the purview of labor officialdom. And I think one outcome of the pandemic is that workers really took matters into their own hands. It was hard for organizers and union staff to meet with people on the job during COVID. It was like sometimes illegal. So there was a new kind of effervescence that bubbled up, which was really, really significant.
And beyond what we've already discussed, I mean, there might have been an opportunity for some workers in, say, like the economic crash of 2008, maybe to make to flex their muscle, but like the conditions just weren't right at that time. What was so different, like 12 years later or 13 years later?
Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, you know, that time after the Great Recession did give rise to Fight for 15, which originally was Fight for 15 and a union, which was at the time a utopian demand. Like, no, I could double the minimum wage at McDonald's, and then they did, right? In a lot of places. And so that was a pretty momentous thing. There was some overlap between Occupy and the Fight for 15, especially in the unions where, you know, inequality was such a huge part of their discourse or their reality. But yeah, there wasn't the kind of explosion that we saw. There was an explosion in 2018, 2019 with the Red for Ed movement, but that was very siloed. Like, it was basically copycat strikes in one industry. And during the pandemic, the essential working class was broad. Like, I mean, it is in to some extent still broad. And you had nurses making connections with delivery drivers and teachers and daycare providers in ways that we don't typically see. And so I think for that reason, early on, the strikes and protests and walkouts and disruptions were not siloed by one industry. They were not confined to one teachers or nurses or whatever. It was like pretty broad. And Striketober was sort of an example of that. Like, there was rolling strikes in a variety of different industries, big and small, and some with strong labor presences and some with almost none. And I think that variety was sort of a hallmark of pandemic labor organizing.
Cross industry solidarity,
exactly.
and an understanding that, like, you know, we're all in this together, but that's so much easier to create when you're all in it together and you have you're a nurse or you're a teacher or you're right. A miner. But there was there's a shared collective understanding that an experience of being that essential worker under that huge umbrella that is just impossible to ignore. And it's clearly a driver here.
Right. I mean, we typically think of class in America as a socioeconomic number. Right. It's like, oh, you make this much money and you work at, you know, a restaurant, you're a working class person or whatever. In reality, like, there are masses of people out there who make X amount of money. And then there are classes. Like, classes form. They form in action. And the pandemic working class, like, came into formation. And to some extent, it dissolved out of formation, right? Like, at a certain point, the solidarity that held people together across those industries did begin to diminish. And it was undermined by, you know, a variety of factors. But there was a moment when a real frontline class formed based on people's proximity to risk. Like, did you risk your life when you went to work? Then you're with us. And if you didn't, then you're not. And, you know, vaccines, unemployment insurance, the changing winds of the pandemic, all those things impacted that calculus and that risk factor. But early on, that proximity to risk was a real driver of working class consciousness.
It's so well said. And in, I think, chapter 4 of your book, you talk about how unions in general, and you emphasize the point of how much the impact that they have on workplace safety in mm-hmm. general. If we could zoom out for a second, just looking at unions and how important they are. And we've tried to highlight at least once a week on this program, some sort of like organizing that's happening. And, but just to hammer that point home for people, how do unions protect you in your workplace?
Yep. So we typically think of workplace safety as a factor of like macroeconomic policy. In other words, if you have a bad job, you can quit it. And that incentivizes your boss to make the workplace better, to make the job better. The other possibility is that OSHA or some other institution will safeguard your workplace. And so we typically you know, referred to workplace safety as a matter, an outcome of one of those two factors. In my book, it's different. And actually during the pandemic, it was different. So workers kept themselves safe and they kept the rest of us safe. So unions have always been guarantors of workplace safety. They're associated with lower rates of disease. They're associated with, you know, making more money so you can afford better care, better, you know, preemptive care, so to speak. They're associated with lower hours. Longer hours is a huge contributor to poor health. And working and union members have better health insurance. So all those factors are always true. During the pandemic, I worked with a team of researchers to study a couple different industries. So the most important one probably was nursing homes, which was the epicenter of the virus for the first, you know, year and a half. If you had a union in your nursing home, residents there were about 10% less likely to die of COVID than if there was no union. Workers were about 8% less likely to be infected by the virus if they had a union. You know, and partially, in other words, like those are real material things, you know, like we're talking fewer deaths. So in other words, if you extrapolate those numbers out and imagine the entire industry being unionized, that saves about 8,000 excess deaths. And all those people have family, friends, and loved ones who that effect ripples out to. The reason was to some extent simple. Like workers have a voice on the job and workers can, they have better access to PPE. Like throughout the pandemic, unionized workers have better access to masks and gloves and eye shields and gowns. I talked to nursing home workers who were using like umbrellas and old raincoats, like for PPE without a union. That stuff was not common when you had protection. So nursing home workers, you know, went on strike, did walkouts, held protests, and those things, you know, build up your power, build up your voice on the job, and it makes a big difference.
And so it's no shock that in terms of where labor stood, they, from an organizing perspective, it was, let's take COVID seriously, as opposed to the management or the boss position of getting back to normal.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, unions had a real incentive to do right by their members in a lot of ways, you know, because if you're a low wage healthcare worker, like I interviewed tons of nursing home aides and they made, their wages were so low that they would have to work at two or three different nursing homes to make a living. What that meant during the pandemic was that you spread COVID,
right,
like among the very patients that you were helping to keep alive. And everyone said this. Everyone's like, I know, like that I am contributing to this virus spreading, nice. And yet I'm the only one here that can save us, you know, to some extent. And if you make $3 or $4 more an hour, you know, that actually translates into, well, maybe I don't have to work two jobs, right? Like those kind of things make, you know, if I have employer-paid health insurance, I don't have to work longer hours just to get health insurance, which means like, you know, I can have break times, I can have rest times, I can sleep better, I can take care of myself. And really, you know, a major theme throughout the book is the working conditions of essential workers are the living conditions of the rest of us. Like, we're all better off if we're all better off. And we want those people, you know, working nursing home jobs to make $30 an hour and to have like full, you know, like nursing aides were excluded from the CARES Act, like protections under the CARES Act. Like we relied on them to save people and then we left them to die. And it's really, it's a shocking, you know, it's a shocking fact about how we treat the people at the bottom. So you can consider the working class people as either the bottom or a foundation of democracy. And those are two very different things. They sort of sound like the same word, but they're very different.
Yes. Before I let you go, I wanted to talk to you about the discussion about a worker shortage that we're experiencing right now in the U.S. What's your take on how that has been framed by governmental officials, elected officials, media, etc., in contrast to the reality of what it actually means?
We just have a surplus of bad jobs. That's basically what the American economy is. Like, for the last 20 years, we have hollowed out middle-paying, decent jobs, and we've added far more jobs at the bottom of the income ladder. And as jobs have gotten worse, like healthcare protections have gotten worse. And as healthcare protections have gotten worse, like people's safety have gotten worse. Like, it's really like, I don't know what the metaphor is, a dominoes thing or something. And so we have a surplus of bad jobs. During the pandemic, you know, during the height of the pandemic, the labor shortage was actually not that confusing. Like, the census asks everyone, why weren't you working last week? And you can just read that data. And it says that people were caring for loved ones or themselves or children who were sick with COVID. That's basically what happened for 18 months. And we still have a crisis of care. Like, daycare centers closed and never reopened. Childcare providers shut down. Like, there's still millions of families who can't work because they can't find care for their kids, elderly, what have you. You know, people took families out of nursing homes and are caring for them more by themselves now because those places were so dangerous. So I think we're still seeing, like, the care crisis as driving, to some extent, the labor shortage. The other thing is that, you know, people, that's one explanation. The other one really is that people did become just completely fed up with dead-end work. Granted, tons of people are still doing it, but I think there are fewer and fewer people who are looking for it. And, you know, some industries that basically have bad jobs, like restaurants are not coming back the way they were 4 years ago. We're not going to have as many. And we just have to live with that fact, because the jobs, you know, working in the kitchen or the front of the house at most restaurants is a pretty demeaning and demoralizing $2.35 an hour job. And we just, you know, we should have less of them. And I think a large amount of people are beginning to realize that.
I mean, and it is you can also trace that back to outsourcing, globalization, the United States becoming a service economy largely. And so it just takes one shock, like the coronavirus pandemic, for that house of cards to begin to tip over.
Right, right. Well, American employers are, like, addicted to low-wage service jobs, and we have to break that addiction. Like, there's nothing inherently bad about service work. You know, we think of those, like, menial, minimum wage, sort of cashier type, you know, jobs as being inherently bad. We once thought about that about industrial working class jobs, which bloomed the middle class in the middle of the 20th century. Those jobs were made better. They were made better by organizing and policy and unions. And service sector jobs can be good too. And I think, you know, if we have a service economy, there's no reason it has to be inferior to an economy dominated by middle-class manufacturing. We just, right now, like, the priority to do that is not there. I mean, Biden came in guns blazing. I'm the next pro-union, or I'm the biggest pro-union president since, I don't know, Lincoln or something. And that evaporated pretty quick, you know? And some of that has to, you know, has to apply pressure on him to bring back some of those promises.
100%. Well, can't thank you enough, Jamie McCallum. The book is entitled Essential: How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. And Jamie has a few other books that you can also check out as well. And I know you can check out his writing in a bunch of different places. Mother Jones, I saw Dissent, right? Some other magazines that we like over here at the Majority Report. Thanks so much, Jamie. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Emma.
Of course. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Garrett Bruhaug. We are back, and we are joined now by Garrett Bruhaug, a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, and he is here to explain the latest breakthrough in fusion energy and what it really means. Garrett, thanks so much for coming on today.
Yeah, happy to come on and explain it.
Thanks.
I guess, where do you want me to jump in?
So I was explaining to him briefly while we were setting up his shot. I am a science philistine in many respects. When I read about this, I was incredibly excited, right? Where like the mainstream media reports on this fusion reaction were glowing. Government scientists have achieved this massive breakthrough. Can you explain what that means for our audience? And then we can go through kind of some of the more practical realities.
Yeah, so I guess going all the way back, nuclear fusion is one of the two big nuclear reactions that we can use to get energy. Fission is what we use right now in reactors. It's where we split something heavy like uranium. My lights are actually currently being kept on by a fission reactor, so I'm glad that works. Fusion is what we would like to have in the future, and maybe for like space and things like that. It's what powers the sun. And it's also what powers hydrogen bombs, which is part of the impetus for research on it. What happened at Lawrence Livermore National Labs last week is they achieved what we call ignition. You can argue they actually did it last year, but this year was the real official set point. There's what a scientist would consider, and there's what the government set as a solid bar to make sure that there was no games being played. And you can think of it like this. Imagine we have a bonfire we want to light, right? And we have some sort of new kind of super clean burning wood that we want to use. And we know from our young and youthful and crazy days setting off nuclear bombs that if we use a flamethrower, we can light the bonfire. But that's not really useful. That's dangerous and bad. The goal was to figure out how to light just a little bit of it in a very controlled fashion. And what we did last week was show that we could get a little bit of it to burn with more energy, to release more energy than it took to actually light it. And we've been working on this for 60 years. The fuel was able to self-heat. Now, it did not actually make more energy than was totally put into the system. The electricity to charge the lasers was far more than the energy that the fusion reaction put out. But the fusion reaction put out more energy than the lasers put in. And that's what we really care about for understanding the physics. We've never done that outside of a nuclear weapon before. And it is huge to be able to do it inside of the lab. It allows us to study what actually happens in an ignited plasma, which is a really big deal for making any kind of fusion reactor. But we also know from our crazy youthful days that you can scale this up quite quickly. So just, you know, once you get a little bit of wood burning, you know, you can get a lot of wood burning without too much more effort. It was just figuring out how to light it.
Yeah. So, I mean, how surprising was this breakthrough? What had this, I mean, you talk about how they've been working on this since for decades, since what, the 1950s on fusion. And they finally had this massive breakthrough. But in terms of how this was building, was this expected or surprising?
So it was both surprising and expected. And I'll explain why I use those two terms. The facility where this happened, the National Ignition Facility, you'll notice ignition is in the name. They got that funded, and it was proposed that we understood fusion so well from all of our nuclear weapons testing that we could just build this big laser and it was just going to work. That there were claims when they were getting this thing built back in like the early 2000s, the very first shot was going to make so much fusion it would damage the facility. And it was going to be just the most beautiful and amazing scientific achievement. Well, they started up in 2008, I want to say, and you'll notice they didn't get it. And it's been many years, many very embarrassing years of having a facility called the National Ignition Facility with no ignited plasma. Now, this most recent shot was expected that we were going to get something like this soon, because last year in August, we had a surprise shot that got so much more yield than we were expecting. It did actually cause some damage. It did not pass the government threshold for ignition. But all of us in the field were like, oh, my God, we did it. We know how to go from here. So it was kind of just a matter of time. And an important thing to keep in mind is that the National Ignition Facility takes a really long time to set up all these experiments. So we're not, it's not like we're shooting these pellets once every minute and being like, why aren't they lighting? Why aren't they lighting? There's maybe 10 really high yield fusion experiments per year. The laser is used for other things. It's used for national security related applications, and it's also used for pure science. There's a lot of really amazing studies of things like white dwarfs and centers of planets and cool like astrophysics, and all of that takes time where they could be doing fusion. So the fact that they went from nothing, almost no fusion yield at all, to getting up, 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 getting a surprise shot, and then this ignition moment, it is a pretty impressive feat. It was over the course of, I think, 300 times they pulled the trigger on a fusion shot. It's pretty few to be iterating.
Now, this laser or this technology, I guess, at the NIF, I saw on your Twitter thread on this that there's it's a bit outdated to a degree. And there's going to be an issue potentially now, especially with the Republicans taking the House, with maybe getting some funding to capitalize on some of this technological achievement. Where is it where is it behind where it should be to continue some of the experimentation that you describe?
So all big science machines tend to be surprisingly old in terms of the technology used. We have to pick what is safe at the time, right? You have to pick a technology that you trust you can build this multi-billion dollar machine taking taxpayer money and that it will actually work. So NIF, the NIF was commissioned in 1992 to begin construction. So they decided to use laser technology from, say, 1982. So this is before we even get, you know, Ronnie Reagan's Star Wars program pushing lasers forward. We had better laser technology at smaller scale. No one was going to fund it for the NIF. The point was just to make the darn thing work. It didn't matter how inefficient and bad it was. It just needed to put lasers on target. We've had many decades of wonderful advancement, both on civilian and military sides, and also for fusion applications. The lasers are looking a lot better. Like you said, though, the question is going to be funding to actually get a new facility built. There's already serious talk of proposals of new facilities where I'm at in Rochester, where we have the little sister to the NIF, as well as facilities moving past the National Ignition Facility. I actually think we are in a better boat than you would expect politically, and that's because the NIF is connected to military applications as well because of stockpile stewardship. You can usually convince the Republicans to jump on board for that sort of stuff. You just kind of wave your hands and say military, and then they will, you can get your money for whatever science you want to do. It happened during the Reagan era. There was a lot of this will totally defend us from the Soviets, and it was worthless for that. But it's all about playing the smart political games. And fusion is hot right now. We've got, there's talk of clean energy, there's talk of an energy crisis, and everyone wants to push forward on it. So I think we are liable to get new facilities that can really build off of it. Timelines are always the question. And, who knows, maybe someone like, what's his face, Ted Cruz or whatever, does a poison pill. Who knows?
Let's hope not, because all we just have to say is military, as you say, but don't say it too loud because then it's giving it away. But I'm wondering if you could expand a bit more on the reason that this, if it's able to be advanced, this kind of technology would be so beneficial for moving towards a future where our energy systems are not contributing to, say, the destruction of the planet. Move away from carbon intensive energy, right? What does it really mean in terms of our fight to reduce the effects of climate change?
So my honest opinion on it is that fusion is probably not hitting at the time frame we really need. I mean, it's one of those things, we should always be pushing new technologies forward. We want to have new stuff coming online as much as possible. but we also need to be deploying things now. So you kind of have to weigh that mix. Now, of course, the amount of money going into fusion research really is nothing compared to, say, the IRA bill, where the NIF was built over budget at $3.5 billion over the course of 15 years. That's a drop in the bucket. And we could build newer facilities in that sort of time frame. Fusion is completely carbon free, so that's very nice. It's basically got all of the attributes of nuclear fission power. It's just a different way of getting nuclear energy. It's going to take a while to get reactors that make net electricity. And then if you read up on the history of, say, how we got fission reactors to where they are now, it's going to take a while to get them to be reliable and cheap and things that we can really use to plug big parts of our power usage. But if you don't start now, you'll never get there. And right. it is a really compelling way forward. And it's one of those beautiful things that even though it technically burns fuel, the fuel that's burnt, I mean, I got enough in my glass of water to already power the city I'm living in for many, many years. It's a wonderful future energy source. And so it's definitely something, especially because we have this big advancement and broadly in the United States, kind of a lead in fusion technology. We shouldn't give up on it, even if it's not going to come onto the grid next year.
What is the waste that would be produced by this process?
Broadly, the waste issue would come down to activated materials. So fusion makes a lot more neutron radiation than fission, and it will make the walls of the reactor radioactive. This is an issue that we already deal with medical waste and with fission reactors. It's a known problem, just like handling waste from a fission reactor. It's an incredibly small amount of material, all things considered. You look at a fusion reactor and say, wow, that's huge. But then you consider how much energy it made. It's a minuscule amount of waste. We're already working on how you would recycle it. And it would be dangerous for less time than fission waste. Although, you know, you can recycle fission waste and make that not an issue either. It's one of those things that if you put the regulatory bodies in place and the correct incentives, it's not even a problem.
Oh, I'm praying that this continues to be in the government's hands and there isn't like some sort of like private push. I mean, would that even be possible currently for
there is.
Would that worry you? Yeah.
So there is a big private push right now on fusion. That's where a lot of the money is coming in. The exciting part is a lot of these companies are pushing ideas. The government has to kind of just pick a couple safe concepts and push them forward because you're using taxpayer money. These companies are more likely to go for some wild concepts that might pay off. I can't say if they're going to work. Who knows? I think it's great if they keep taking, say, Jeff Bezos's money and playing with it. You know, I'm sure it's a lot of fun. I'm not that worried about any sort of safety concerns, though. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission which is the people that regulate all of this. They're famously harsh in the United States. We have very, very well regulated nuclear activities already, and I don't think there would be any risk when it comes to fusion. The NRC will prevent any issues to the public.
Good. Well, at least in its current iteration, right? Unless this begins to explode, and then there's maybe some deregulatory push, but we can cross that bridge when we come to it. When you talk about fission technology, is that what a lot of the old climate models for a transition to nuclear are based on? And does that make fission more outdated now that we have these new gains in fusion?
So that's basically what every climate model talking about using nuclear would assume, because we hadn't even hit ignition. So no one knew when fusion would come online. We're still a long ways from a power plant. And so all of those climate models assuming fission are very, very on point. And there is no guarantee a fusion power plant or any near-term one is at all competitive. And I don't mean in a market-based sense, but in like making cheap, reliable power for everyone. Current fission reactors are already really good. The ones that we want and are building are even better. And I would very much push people, even though this is an amazing thing to be excited about, it's awesome that we hit this point and we should keep pushing forward on fusion. In no way should we give up on fission. We should push fission forward. We should push the accelerator to the max, because it is a proven way to decarbonize huge chunks of economies, as seen with France and Ontario.
All right. Well, that was so helpful, and I really appreciate you coming on. Garrett Bruhaug, PhD candidate, University of Rochester. You got a Twitter thread where you go into this, and people can check out your page. We'll put a link to it in our description for the podcast. Garrett, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
It was great. Thank you. All right, folks. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. We're going to head into the fun half, where we will be reading your IMs and taking your calls. But first, Matt, how was Left Reckoning last night? How should people check it out?
Oh, gosh. Well, we had Mike Racine on, comedian Mike Racine, to talk about this whole thing about how comedy is going to the right. And everyone, all the good comedians, such as Matt Walsh and Kara Dansky, are all on the right wing now because of trans people basically not making comedy safe on the left. We talked about that and some Twitter stuff and Peru. And I went deep into the recent JFK stuff about the confirmation that Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA asset and that the CIA covered up what they knew about Oswald for years and years and years until basically we were all children. And
I did not see this confirmation. How'd this come out?
This is what Jefferson Morley was talking about recently. Basically, the CIA sources and methods regarding a bunch of things. First of all, what they knew and how closely they were tracking Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the assassination, and how they targeted the Fair Play for Cuba Committee for COINTELPRO infiltration. Fair Play for Cuba Committee had, coincidentally, maybe, or because of that, Lee Harvey Oswald for a member, where he was ostentatiously being a communist in New Orleans and somehow found a right-wing radio outlet to give a interview for. So, anyway.
He gave an interview on the radio?
Yeah, there's a long interview. You can get probably full thing on YouTube if you search Lee Harvey Oswald radio interview in New Orleans. And it's like, he's all like, I haven't listened to it in a while, but it's all like, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, and, you know, it's very clearly, in my opinion, a CIA guy trying to make himself look like a communist and infiltrate stuff.
I mean, I always thought that was, like, implied, but now, if there's new Morley revelations making it a little bit more concrete, that's very exciting.
And just what we know for certain is that when the Warren Commission came out, the CIA said, yeah, I didn't know nothing about that guy. Mm. And that was a lie. So whether folks want to say maybe it was true he wasn't CIA, but that didn't really have anything to do with his actions later, and he was still a lone gunman, CIA still lied about that, buddy. And
why?
we still haven't like had a real accounting for how the CIA could lie about that. And I'll just make one final note so we can get the fun half. But a month to the day of Kennedy being assassinated, Harry S. Truman was in the Washington Post saying, hey, we should maybe look at getting rid of the CIA because it's gotten outside of its purview a little bit, and that could lead to some problems, and it may have gotten out of hand. So let's take a look at that. And, of course, we didn't listen to him, and the CIA is still around and still laundering itself, even as we learn all this stuff. And also the FBI is still hiding documents too. So it's all the stuff about the deep state from the right, and
nothing.
It doesn't seem like those folks are super interested. And also, we should note, Trump could have released all this stuff under his watch, and
buried
he did
it.
Not. Biden is giving us some of it, but he's also, I think, slow walking. We need transparency on this stuff. Come on, like, it's been a long time. But
yep.
Anyway,
yeah. Well, that's fascinating.
That was less of a plug and more of another segment.
Honestly, I mean, I could go forever on that stuff. On ESPN, we spoke about a little bit about the World Cup match. Do we have, is the match happening right now between France and Morocco, or is that at 2 p.m. again today? God, these middle of the day things. Argentina has moved on at this point. But at 2 p.m. they're playing today. That'll be very exciting. We're going to have our final two very soon. We spoke about that on ESPN. Also, I gave a definitive victory lap on the fact that Justin Herbert has been, always will be, better than Tua. It's not really close. Tua is not that good, and he seems like a nice guy, but you can check out me taking that victory lap on ESPN. Also, I spoke about how the Giants are not going to make the playoffs, but I think the Lions will, which is very exciting for Detroit, and more stuff, youtube.com/ESPN show. Now, heading into the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on! To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.